Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I am your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today on episode 186, we take a moment to check in on our producer and current first-year ophthalmology resident, Dr. Louis Kai. Louis and I chatted about 3 weeks into his clinicals at the Wills Eye Hospital in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Our conversation encompassed residency training and education in ophthalmology, the challenges you can face transitioning from general medicine to ophthalmology, and other subjects. We're going to do check-ins with Louis every few months or so as a supplemental episode in addition to our regular episode schedule. A list of financial disclosures, as always, will be attached in the episode description. Remember that you can now claim CME credits via the American Academy of Ophthalmology website for select episodes. Simply click on the link in the episode description to claim your credits. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be joined by our producer, senior audio editor, manager, mascot, professional ping pong association player. Am I missing anything? Dr. Louis Kai from the Wills Eye Hospital, where he is currently a first-year resident. Louis, thank you so much for coming back on the program.
Thank you, Dr. Sridhar, and a really nice introduction.
I try. I need to come up with a better nickname for you.
Yeah, I think the ping pong one is what I'm currently being known for here, more so than the other aspects of my career.
Well, what we're doing, and again, this may not be of interest to everyone listening, but hopefully it will be, because I think we'll keep it interesting. I'm going to be checking in with Louis. Louis is a first-year resident now, and he's been with us since the program started almost 3 years ago. And we're going to be checking in every few months, doing our discussions over the phone, talk about life, talk about retina, and a little bit about the podcast, too, and what we're planning and what we're planning to do. So, and again, this won't be replacing our regular episodes. We'll probably release this as an extra episode on the months when we do it. So, Louis, first of all, two calls in. You're about 3 weeks into your clinicals at Wills. What's it been like so far? So what's the big, let's start with this. What has been the biggest adjustment from going from doing a general medical or surgical year to being an ophthalmology resident?
So definitely the biggest adjustment is just clinical capability. In transitional year, you start to get very, very fluent with the medicine, with the physical exam. You've been doing it for 4 years, and you just feel confident being able to do a full exam on a patient and getting to a pretty good diagnosis and coming up with a plan. But right now, I just feel so handicapped. I feel that when I go into a room, I don't know if I will be able to get the right diagnosis. I don't know if I'll be able to even to see the right pertinent findings. And so just feeling that I have a huge handicap going into every patient encounter. That's probably been the biggest adjustment. And even from day one to day two, I'm seeing myself, you know, being able to do more and more every single day.
Yeah, I think that we talk a lot about the difficulties being a student or an early resident ophthalmology. And, you know, I think it's really important to have a good medical background to be an ophthalmologist. I think whether you're in the OR or the clinic, you deal with systemic conditions, systemic medications. I think that it's important to have a handle on general medicine, but I always wonder if there's better ways to prepare people for certain fields like ophthalmology or dermatology, and there's probably other fields in medicine, radiation oncology, that have like their own language. And those residencies may be longer than other residencies in a sense. You know, to become an ophthalmologist, you have to do 4 PGY years, but you're really only spending 3 of those doing ophthalmology, which is the same as if you did internal medicine, which again, you master a lot more internal medicine as a resident than you did as a student, but at least you have some, like you said, some semblance of the background. You know, they used to talk in medical school that the RIME kind of criteria, do you remember that? Where they're like,
right,
reporter, interpreter, manager, educator, like going up the ladder in terms of what you're able to do. And I think that for most people who are really smart and motivated and qualified, you're definitely an educator, if not by the beginning, but by the end of your intern, you're at least able to educate students and some eyes who work with you, and then you become an ophthalmology resident, and it's really difficult to be anything more than a reporter, and sometimes you're not even the most reliable reporter because you don't know what you're seeing. So I wonder, we could take this as a different conversation, but I just always wonder, are there ways to speed up that learning curve? I'm not saying that we should have our own specialized school for ophthalmology, but are there any ways to speed that learning curve up besides, for example, things that have been discussed, you know, 5 years of residency, which I think no one's a fan of, or making the first year kind of a hybrid medicine ophthalmology year, which is great in a vacuum, but then also kind of limits your flexibility in your terms of where you can live and what you're kind of stuck to versus being stuck married to one place for 3 years. Now you're married to a place for 4 years in a lottery match type of system.
Right. So the thing is, I was very fortunate because in my TY year, I did get 2 months of ophthalmology rotation, and I credit a lot of my ability to feel comfortable to those rotations in my transitional year, because without them, I wouldn't be able to use the 90 diopter lens at all. Like, I would be still struggling to put my hand in the right place on the headpiece, putting in a red, where should I put my hand? Where should I turn the slit lamp on? Like, these are some fundamental skills that really require rote practice. And so without those rotations, I really felt like it would have been even more hard to start. But I definitely relate to the whole reporter thing. Like, I don't even feel like I'm a reliable reporter, and I don't know when I will feel I will be a reliable reporter. Oftentimes I see things and in the back of my head, I say to myself, this is probably just a variant of normal. And another thing that I always tell my attendings is, I didn't find such and such. I didn't find dot blot heme or a cotton wool spot, but I have a very, very high false negative rate. So take whatever I report with a grain of salt.
That's funny. You know, and the thing is, I'm not criticizing the system, because obviously it's trained many, many great ophthalmologists who are super qualified, and we all make it. But just because you are able to become good in a system doesn't mean it's the best way for things to be done. And so, I don't know. I like you said, it's useful to have some experience with the lenses. When I have students, I think it's hard, but you try to get them involved in scenarios where they can at least try looking. I do also think that unless you're doing something every day like ophthalmology, it's a little bit like learning a new sport, tennis, ping pong, whatever. It's hard if you do it every once in a while versus once you start doing it every day, multiple times a day, then your learning curve accelerates.
Exactly. And back to your original question, like, I feel like personally right now, the best, absolute best way for me to learn would be if I was driving the lens and I had an attending looking at my lens and saying, oh, that's that, that's that, that's that. And I can ask, what is this? What is that? What is this? What is that? And then that's like when I'm actually very fortunate to start on a comprehensive clinic. And one of the procedures that we're able to do in there are the YAG capsulotomies. So when I'm doing them and I have an attending watching through the eyepiece, I can say, is this close enough? Is this far enough? Like, am I focused in the right place? And I feel that when an attending is there just watching me do it and observing my technique, because a lot of the issue with these things is after you've been doing for a long time, everything becomes second nature. And I don't know when the last time you thought about how you held the 90 diopter lens, how far you held it from the face, how much your fingers were extended. But those were all questions that I had first starting, like, how much should I put my 20 diopter lens away from the face? And I learned, oh, I read that 6 inches or whatever, 6 centimeters or 8 centimeters. And these things are all second nature, because by now you probably put your hand in the automatic right position and you see perfectly. But when first starting, like, I don't know, am I too close? Am I too far? Is my head too close? Is my head too far? These are all questions that are running through my head, but only when someone's watching me do the exam will I get those answered.
Yeah, that's a great point. And there's multiple things to unpackage there. I think the first thing you referenced about having that feedback, one of the things we did research on when I was a fellow and when I was really motivated was for indirect exams, we got like a hookup where you had a video screen and attending could watch what you were seeing and could kind of comment. Because I think it's really difficult, unless you've been doing it a long time. And I'll give an example. Dr. James Banta used to do the indirect teaching for the residents and the medical students at Bascom Palmer in the past, and he since moved on to Oregon. But he was excellent at our institution in terms of he could just kind of look at your hand and change your position, and he kind of knew if you were seeing what you were supposed to be seeing or not, just from the side, just by seeing where your hands were. And that's probably from a lot of reps in terms of doing it and seeing what people see. But it's not something that is easy for everyone to do as an attending to just kind of look at it. I think for many attendings, they're kind of stumped and they kind of, and sometimes you'll look and be like, well, I'm not exactly sure what you're doing right or wrong here, but I can tell you this is right and this is wrong. And that's not necessarily as helpful. And that's why, like you said, just doing it over and over again, you kind of learn for yourself what to do. I wonder again, if you got more sort of feedback, like we talk about, we videotape our surgeries in the OR, and you learn a lot by watching yourself operate in terms of your inefficiencies, your tendencies, things you can do better, things you could do well. I almost wonder that in the future, there may not be a market for it from a financial perspective, but if there was any way that the lenses were always hooked up to some sort of digital output that you could record all your exams, you probably would learn a lot about, you know, especially if the lens could give you some sort of feedback, a lot about what you need to do.
I think the second thing
that's really difficult that you referenced, and I've talked about this with surgery before, is everyone's hands and refractive error is a little bit different, their height. And that makes, for example, an indirect exam really difficult to know exactly where the lens needs to be for each person. Everyone's hand size is different, how much they need support on the head is different. There is no one size fits all. And I'm a mild myope at this point, so my distances are going to be different than someone who's emmetropic. Those also make it really difficult to kind of coach or teach people.
Right. I remember the first week of one of my clinics, I sat down to try to calculate my optimal distance, you know, with my refractive error and the patient's, like, assuming a patient's refractive error, and try to calculate the optimal distance between, like, the whatever the virtual image between my 20 diopter lens, and eventually it became just too much. And then I just resort to just zooming in and pulling back until I see something. So I'm still working on that.
I think the hard thing when you start anything too, and this is again true in the operating room, but in the clinic, is when things aren't going well, you automatically assign responsibility to yourself. So you're like, well, I can't get a view. It must be because I don't know what I'm doing or I'm not doing correctly. And then sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's there's media opacity. Sometimes the patient isn't in the right position, or their head, chin's tucked for an indirect exam, or their forehead's not touching the bar when you're trying to look. And those things make it difficult to see. And some of those things are correctable by watching the attending do it. But sometimes it's really gratifying and helpful to see the attending sit down, look, and be like, actually, this is a very tough view.
Yeah.
It's the same idea in the operating room. Sometimes I'll have a fellow or someone, or even I was learning, you struggle with something. And then you realize the reason you're struggling to tie that suture isn't because you don't know how to tie. It's because the forceps aren't good, or there's something else. And I think most of us don't have the ego where we blame other external circumstances. We like to kind of look inward and think it's us. And that's also hard to know what's normal and what's actually probably outside your control that you need to look for.
Yeah, that's experience driven for sure.
So you talked about doing some YAGs and procedures. You've talked about the adjustment of becoming an ophthalmology resident. We've talked about a lot of difficulties. Let's talk about the big positives though. I mean, has it been what you expected? Are you excited? Do you think you made the right choice?
Yeah, like I was telling people who are saying, like, how's Philadelphia, how's residency? And I tell everyone, this is like, if my happiness could be rated on a scale of 1 to 10, like, I'm at a 15 right now. Like, this is like the most happy and like fulfilled that I've ever been. And there are times where I'm at home and I'm reading and I can't sleep because I'm so excited to go to clinic the next day to like try out this new strategy to make my indirect exam better or make my 90 exam better. And even though I'm on call, like, I still look forward to going to the emergency room and look forward to seeing every new patient, because I feel like every new patient I'm growing in some way. And definitely you have to approach it from a mindset that it's okay to be bad. It's okay to be a beginner. And the thing is, I played a lot of video games where you start off as a beginner, and this is the most exciting time. The worst time is when you start to feel like you're plateauing and you're not improving, and you feel like you don't see like the big changes in your exam or your progress. And that's actually worse than feeling like you're a beginner. And because right now, like, leveling up in the beginning in the game is the most exciting time. And just like right now, leveling up in ophthalmology is in the very beginning is probably going to be the most exciting. I'll probably feel for the rest of my life or the rest of my career.
Yeah, it's true. That's a really good analogy, actually. I think that it's almost like a game is a good example. I think it's also true for if you play a sport or you do anything recreational. I think the part that's the hardest, but also maybe the most gratifying, is when you start, because you make the most visible improvement.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, you know, I used to run cross country in high school, and, you know, ran the season. And I remember at the beginning that the basic thing is you just run a mile and a half, you stretch, and you run a mile and a half back when you're starting. And if you can, you build up to doing that. Remember, the first day you struggle through, the second day is miserable because you're super sore and you can't do it. But you can actually do it within a couple of weeks. Running is nice in that way because you actually build stamina much faster than other physical, you know, sort of exertions. Mm-hmm. And then the doldrums, or kind of the valley, is the part in the middle where it's like, well, you kind of make a decision. Do I want to be truly, truly much better at this, knowing that the amount of effort I need to invest is a lot to get to the next hump? or do I just kind of maintain where I am? And I think that that's where it's harder to kind of maintain the excitement and the drive.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what really separates out the people who truly love what they do, but also find different challenges or things to motivate them.
Mm-hmm.
That's, for example, once you get comfortable with your indirect and slit lamp exam, do you push yourself? So like Will Park, who was a fellow when I was a resident, used to say, well, if it's a slow day in clinic, I didn't do this all the time, but if it's a slow day, pull out your gonio lens and start looking at people who are normal. So you get comfortable doing that, because otherwise you're only going to be doing it in scenarios where you don't, it's not normal, and then you don't know what you're looking at. Or surgically, it would be pushing yourself to try different techniques if you're doing cataract surgery or something. I mean, some people just don't go that extra amount, and that's okay. And I think part of that is because it's difficult to make the extra jump. But the payoff, if you get to the point where you're like truly, truly, you know, and I'm not at this point, I don't think many of us are at the point where you're truly, truly like excellent, that's where I think it also gets fun. So it's a lot more fun to be Roger Federer than to be the 100th ranked tennis player in the world.
Right.
You know, it's just a much better life. But they have, obviously there's a talent there, but the amount of work to get to that point is the part you don't see. And the video game analogy is good, because most of us who play video games, we remember the beginning as being a lot of fun. We remember the ending as being a lot of fun, but I'm sure there's parts in the middle where like, I don't really ever want to play that part.
Yeah. Right now I'm just enjoying the thrill of being a beginner, and it's been tiring, but it's really, really fun, and I'm really glad to be in this field.
Yeah, yeah. So this is going to reflect age. Did you play Diablo 2 growing up, or you're too young?
So I have played Diablo 3 before, and just briefly, but then Resident Evil started.
Oh, yeah, that game, I didn't play it. I was too old at that point, but that game is not good, apparently. No, but yeah, it's just funny to think about games, and like there's certain parts that you really like, and there's parts in the middle you're like, God, that was the worst. I just never want to do that.
Is there something in Residency that's like that?
Well, I think that you're going to hit that point. I think at least it depends how your program is structured, right? Yeah. So I think that every program's a little different in terms of where your busiest year is. Mm-hmm. I think you're at a program where it's busy first year, but it really gets busy after Memorial Day, mm-hmm. like May on through that May through May stretch is really, really busy.
Mm-hmm.
For us, it was kind of just the full first year, like post buddy call mid-August, the first year through the end. And I think for us, it was post OCAP. So you take your OCAP, which is your annual assessment, in March, and it's almost like you took your final exam in college or whatever in high school, or your shelf exams in med school, but there's no actual end. It's your introduction to the real world, right? Mm. And in the real world, you take an assessment and life just keeps going. There's patients the next day, there's work the next day, life doesn't get any easier. If anything, more responsibility is assigned to you towards the end of that time, because people look at you and say, well, you're almost a second year now. You should be doing this, this, and this. So I think that's the part where you really have to maintain that extra level burst at the end. And I think for you, it's probably going to be that second half of second year where you really need to maintain it, because you're going to be busy and you're going to work really hard, and you're going to have other things on your mind too.
Right.
You know, being a resident, if you're going to start career planning, right, you're starting thinking about fellowship, you're starting to think about, if you're not doing fellowship, jobs, you're starting to think about what you want out of your life post-training. And you know what, honestly, I think it's kind of a good preparation for going out into the world, because what happens, you go out in the world and you work, and, you know, there's no grand party at the end of things. You know, you work to take good care of people, you work to make a good income and support your family and your loved ones, you work to reach individual personal fulfillment, but you also have to have other things to keep you going. And for everyone, that's a little bit different. And deciding what's important or not for the first time becomes what you think is important, not what some committee or admissions board or, you know, fellowship committee or selection group thinks. It's more what do you think is actually important to yourself?
Right. I remember you interviewed, I forget who exactly, but it was talking about finding a balanced career as an ophthalmologist and taking care of yourself and all those things. And the first year of residency and the first couple of weeks, I've really come to understand what motivates me, what drives me. And it's really, I just can't feel like I'm stagnating. I always feel like I need to find what the next thing to perfect, the next thing to get better at. And so I'll look forward to kind of, you know, doing that thing that Richard Park said, going to people who are normal. And eventually, hopefully later on this year, I'll start trying out scleral depression and things like that.
Yeah, that's great. It's good to hear things are good. And, you know, you've obviously done a great job along with Michael and Angela. You guys are all not in medical school, you're in training, and when you're in training, you're busy, and you guys have done a great job keeping up with the podcast and keeping things going, and we're getting close to 200, which is pretty incredible to think about.
Didn't we say we were going to stop at 200 when we first started?
Do you want to?
No.
This would be momentous, groundbreaking news. This would be some people wouldn't even listen to this episode, and they wouldn't even know that we decided that we're going to end. You know, I think we said we'd reassess. I think I said that, right? Didn't I say 200 and then we'll see?
Reassess. Yeah.
You know, I don't know. People ask me that question a lot. I think 5 years is a good goal at this point. Two more years, and then we kind of see what we want to do. You know, I think that media is going to change. I don't think podcasts are going to be dead in 2 years, but I do think that eventually people are going to be watching videos instead of listening. But I could be wrong.
Yeah, well, the thing is, the issue with videos that I was thinking about, we're kind of tangent here, but the issue with videos is how many videos are you bombarded with every single day, and how long is your attention span going to be for a video? It's very difficult because we have so many videos on Facebook, social media, you know, and then videos on news sites, videos just we watch for entertainment, and videos like Netflix, you know, there's just too much video. And when we have the option of watching a video for entertainment versus watching a video, it's hard to kind of split our attention span with video. But for podcasts, you know, we have to commute. We have to go, we have to exercise. We have to get to places, and it's hard to watch things, you know, while doing that.
Yeah, it's a good point. I think attention spans are only going to get worse, though. And I think that the one advantage of audio over video is you can... Now, commuting may change because people may be in self-driving cars ultimately. But you can't... It's hard to work out unless you're on a stationary device. You're like lifting weights or doing anything where you're running. It's hard to work out and watch something. Though we may end up in like a WALL-E future where everyone's walking around with their personal goggles watching something at all times. Yeah, I think that that's a good point. There's definitely still room for what we do. And yeah, I think that that's a conversation we'd have to think about. We need to start planning what we want to do for 200. I haven't come up with any brilliant ideas. I was thinking we'd just sit down like we did for 100 and just talk and kind of outline what we want to do. But I'm open. The crazy thing is 200 lines up with our 3-year anniversary, which means that on average, we produce 66 to 67 episodes a year, which is pretty good.
I was thinking about the other day, like the total amount of hours that you've spoken on air.
It's way too many. My quality of analysis to ratio to hours spoken on the podcast is a very low number. I think yours is going to be a much higher. You have a much higher yield. If they just picked out the times Louis Kai spoke, that'd be higher yield than listening to me.
But definitely... it's coming back. Definitely been an exciting time. And then I look forward to, you know, finally being able to be an ophthalmologist. So the most difficult thing that I've been experiencing is when a lot of times through patient encounters and just how the ER is set up and how clinics are set up is that oftentimes it's very easy to run behind. And when a patient is already coming into the room a little bit frustrated about the encounter length, and you are also a beginning resident, and the patient probably sense that you don't feel completely confident and to run at full speed. I've been called out a bunch of times. Are you new here? Are you even a doctor? Are you a resident? How come I'm not seeing an attending? And dealing with that in the beginning and saying, yes, it's true that I am new, but I will try my best to deliver care. I think that's a very uncomfortable position to be in when you're first starting out, for sure.
It doesn't get any less comfortable.
Oh, no.
Or less uncomfortable, I should
say. Oh, no.
You're similar to me, I think. We don't like keep people waiting. We don't want people to wake unnecessarily. And I think that, you know, there's a couple things at work there that have been spoken about. One is we work in a field where a demand of patients is starting to exceed the number of providers. You know, they're just depending on where you work, there's too many patients that need to be seen sometimes, all who have real issues. The second is we live in a world where, because of financial pressures on institutions and individuals, they're seeing much more people in a shorter amount of time than they did 40 or 50 years ago. And this isn't Dr. Don Gass's clinic where he can see 5 patients in a morning and look with the macular contact lens and spend an hour talking to them and outlining everything on paper. This is a different world in terms of what's required and demanded from you.
Yeah.
Though there is a lot of variability job to job. Patients have never had higher kind of expectations in terms of how little they wait. our patient population is much younger in some ways than other. Even though we have an aging population, we have a lot of diabetics and younger patients who work, who need to get back to work, or older patients who have younger people who are driving them who need to get back to work. So there's a lot more burden on the workforce.
Yeah.
And we have people now who, because we're in a world where you can, you know, it's not 40 years ago where you're like, oh, I didn't love that restaurant down the street, I'm just going to a different one. You're not going to write a letter to your newspaper saying you hated the restaurant. Now you can just go on Yelp and write a review. And that sort of thing applies to doctors and physicians' offices too, where people are getting reviewed. And people, once people feel like they have more of a voice, for better or worse, they feel like they can, you know, post their real comments, and they're much more intolerant of customer satisfaction issues like a long waiting time or a front desk that's not so friendly.
Yeah.
And doctors are much more cognizant of that because we're being evaluated based on that by our patients, and that may factor into quality measures in the future. So my point is, I'm not trying to be a Debbie Downer for you. I think it does get better as you get more comfortable. It definitely gets better even in practice. You get your flow and you understand how you want to organize your clinics and everything.
Yeah.
But if you care about people not waiting, it is unfortunately a big stressor. And it's even a bigger stressor in retina compared to other fields because you may have emergencies or other things to take care of more often than in a comprehensive type practice. Though I'm sure there are emergencies that come in post-op or otherwise in those practices as well.
Yeah. And then the thing is, one of the issues, I guess, as a resident we experience is, should I, because part of me wants to sit down and kind of nitpick all the things I found. And on the other hand, like, the more I spend learning, the more frustrated my next patient will be. I have to balance those two things. Some of the stuff I can't just ask or figure out. I have to just let it go and figure it out later.
Yeah. And I think that it also depends on the, we've talked about this before too, it depends where you're practicing. I think that we're very blessed in many ways. Patients down in Florida, especially in Miami, there's a lot more tolerance for physicians and a lot more respect for the medical community, which is, again, everything's a double-edged sword. That's great if you're a well-meaning provider. It can be bad if you're someone, unfortunately, who takes advantage of that. In the Northeast, I know, and Philly's not really true Northeast, but it's more along the spectrum. I think that patients tend to have a little bit more caution and suspicion about medical providers. And again, double-edged sword, that's good because it means that people aren't as easily taken advantage of and there isn't as much fraud or other things. And it can be difficult, you know, in terms of flow or managing expectations. But I think it just depends on where you live and practice. Very, very different attitudes. And we see it even within cities. There are different enclaves or communities that are very different from one another. Before I let you go, things are otherwise good. You're liking Philly. You live in your Chinatown, I'm hoping.
Yeah, I've been to Chinatown every single time I have a free moment to go eat. It's been exactly what I imagined I was going to do.
What's your favorite restaurant?
Favorite restaurant has to be, let me try to think. I can't say yet because I've tried only a couple of them. And what I'm starting to realize is that they serve very much the same dishes presented in different ways. So I'm not used to this yet. I feel like it's just all one big restaurant.
That's great. Mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite bubble tea place yet?
I'm partial to VV bubble tea.
But, well, that place is good. It's a little sweet.
Yeah, we'll see. I'd love to try all of them. A lot of people like Kung Fu tea, but I don't feel like their portions are well balanced. But anyway.
Interesting.
Regardless.
All right, Louis. Thanks so much for catching up with this. Best of luck at Will's. And hopefully, I'm trying to see if I can come down there in November. Hopefully, I'll see you then.
All right. Sounds good. Nice talking with you.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. All 186 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. There's also our blog, Equal Round and Reactive Lessons from Our Pupils. And remember, you can claim CME credits for select podcasts via the AAO website. Simply log in as an AAO member and visit the link in the episode description. Also on the website, you can sign up for our mailing list to get updates on the most recent episodes. At the bottom are links to subscribe in the Apple Podcast Store as well as Google Play. You can also like our Facebook page or find us at the Apple Podcast Store or Android Store directly. We're on Twitter at Retina Podcast, and to contact us, click on the contact us link on our website or email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. Feedback is the lifeblood of what we do, so we love getting it. It tells us what we can do better and reinforces the things we're already doing well. We also appreciate anyone who subscribes via the Android Store or Apple Podcast Store. Please leave your positive comments in the form of a review. Many thanks to Dr. Louis Kai for joining me. Thanks to Dr. Louis Kai, Dr. Angela Chang, and Dr. Michael Benincasa for preparing this episode. Listeners, thank you for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.